Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, June 2nd. One tweet that caught my eye this morning is from Samantha Bee, comedian but serious person, as you know. She tweeted, instead of arresting 4,400 people, you could have just arrested four cops. Another one from Robin DiAngelo, author of the book White Fragility. If white people had as much emotional upset and reaction to racial injustice, to the taking of black lives, as we do to the taking of white property, you would not see looting or rioting, tweets Robin DiAngelo. One from former Congresswoman Katie Hill. The same people who freaked out about having to wear masks are totally fine with curfews and martial law. Of course, there are others saying the opposite. Why so concerned about masks last week, but not this, and social distancing? And this from tweeter Kevin O.C. Donald Trump really just had the police fire tear gas and rubber bullets at peaceful protesters in Washington, D.C. to clear the streets for a photo op at a church he doesn't attend with a book he's never read that teaches lessons he doesn't preach. Unbelievable, tweets Kevin O.C. Now, that tweet was referring to the president giving a speech that was not about the death of George Floyd, did not mention police violence or racism as issues, or the grief and anger and, frankly, exhaustion that especially black and brown Americans have been feeling, but others too. He didn't mention the concentration of the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery all together at the same time as black and brown people have been dying of COVID-19 at higher rates than other Americans. He cast people as on sides. What he did say was this.
I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters.
But even as he called himself an ally of peaceful protesters, he was in fact having the police fire tear gas and rubber bullets at peaceful protesters near the White House to clear the streets for him to walk to St. John's Episcopal Church, where presidents sometimes go to pray. The Episcopal Bishop of Washington, Marianne Edgar Buddy, took note.
If he had come to St. John's because he wanted to pray, if he had come to St. John's to lament the death of George Floyd and the grief that has been unleashed across our country, if he had come to offer words of solace and healing and resolve to bind the wounds of our nation, that would have been an appropriate use of the sacred symbol of walking across the park to the church, but he did none of those things. In fact, he used the church and he used the Bible in some ways as symbols to demonstrate or to symbolize American military power.
And Bishop Buddy described the context like this.
He was preceded by a violent clearing of nonviolent protesters to make his way. And he was using our church as a backdrop and the Bible as a prop in ways that I found to be deeply offensive.
The Episcopal Bishop of Washington, Marianne Edgar Buddy, on MSNBC last night. But there was also this from the brother of George Floyd, Terrence Floyd.
So if I'm not over here wilding out, if I'm not over here blowing up stuff, if I'm not over here messing up my community, then what are y'all doing? What are y'all doing? Y'all doing nothing, because that's not going to bring my brother back at all.
Terrence Floyd in grief in Minneapolis yesterday. With me now are Christina Greer, political science professor at Fordham University, politics editor at The Griot, host of the podcast FAQ NYC, and author of the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream, and Jason Johnson, professor at Morgan State University, political contributor at MSNBC, contributor to The Griot and SiriusXM as well. Thanks to both of you for coming on with us today. Good morning.
Morning, Brian.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks so much.
Christina, let's start with the president, but not linger too long on his photo op. Historically, this recalls Richard Nixon running as the law and order candidate in 1968 and winning. Is that what we saw last night in political context?
Well, I think it's too early to think about whether or not this will assist the president in November. I think, you know, Jason Johnson and I have discussed this extensively as to whether or not this president will even promote a free and fair election on November 3rd. But I do think that we've seen this rhetoric of law and order, law and order presidency. And it's definitely a dog whistle to particular Americans, white Americans specifically, to say that I am a true citizen, you all are true citizens, and all these other people who are out here protesting in the middle of a pandemic not only don't deserve to be out here protesting, that the larger context is that they don't deserve to be equal citizens in our nation. And I think that is what is quite concerning for so many people, and that the president will call on the military and police forces who are acting as paramilitary entities to assist him in his white nationalist endeavors.
Jason, how do you see the contradiction specifically of clearing the streets of peaceful protesters while calling himself the ally of peaceful protesters, but basically in his remarks only addressing the looting and not the underlying issues of structural racism and police brutality?
I could not imagine a more incompetent, incapable, and thoroughly underwhelming person to sit in the White House. Everything he's done has been a contradiction. Everything he's done regarding this crisis has been a problem. And I think the idea of choosing a church during broad daylight to deliver a message that has nothing to do with faith. I mean, nothing to do with faith. Everything that the president did yesterday is sort of the example of 12 PR flacks in a room saying, I think this will look good, I think this will look good. Waving a Bible. Remember, this is the individual who said 2 Corinthians at one point. I'm pretty sure he's not all that familiar with any verses that he was referring to. But I think even the larger issue here, and it's something that Dr. Greer referred to, and I think it's something we have to think about long term, is that Donald Trump has never been a president for the United States of America, right? Obviously, he won, even though he got the minority of the vote. But what he does now is really only trained at the small group of individuals who still believe that he's doing a good job. He doesn't care about the protesters. He doesn't care about the people in the suburbs. He doesn't care about the people in the Midwest or the South. He's only talking to his white nationalist base and very, very strong Republicans who will see the idea of the president speaking in front of a church as being a sign of faith and security. For everybody else, he's not a comforter. He's a tormentor.
Christina, the Terrence Floyd clip. I'm reminded of Rodney King, Can We All Get Along, after the uprising in his name, after the cops who beat him were acquitted in court. Can you compare the two?
I think that there's some similar threads in the undercurrent of the foundation. I mean, I think George Floyd's brother does not want to see destruction being done in his late brother's name. But I think the family's been very clear that they understand some of the anguish, and far too often we're focusing on the property damage and not the root as to why people feel the need to boil over and express themselves in this way. And when we read Dr. King, when he breaks down what a riot really means for a lot of people, and it's not even about the material goods, it's about this feeling that white Americans have of freedom that many people in this country have never experienced in any capacity. And this is just the most extreme manifestation of that. I think that, you know, yes, we will have to physically rebuild this nation after these several nights of I would call them uprisings. Some people want to use the words riots. But I think the larger question is, how do we rebuild this nation from a moral and spiritual and racial capacity? And that's the question that far too many Americans don't want to address. It's easier to talk about buildings and what's happening every evening. And yes, it is scary and it's dangerous, but so is being black in America, and it has been for 401 years.
Jason, is it possible to disentangle anarchists, mostly white from what I read, with their own agendas or whoever is bringing hammers and bowling balls and whatever to these protests from rage over the issues that explodes into violence in the last week, so people don't conflate everything as much.
Yeah, Brian, you can. And this is the example I've been using for a couple days now. It's like you can't say that everybody who leaves a party is a drunk driver, right? Yes, some people are going to leave a party and they're going to drive drunk and they're going to cause damage. But a lot of other people at the party, they got Uber, they walked home, they had a designated driver. You know, just because some bad people behave poorly in an event doesn't mean that basically classifies everybody there. It's abundantly clear that the most people who are going out, they are protesting, they've got signs, they've got masks, and they're saying whatever it is they want to say. You do have agent provocateurs. And I think what's important, Brian, is to contextualize this, right? This isn't new. You had agent provocateurs in the 60s and 70s. It was COINTELPRO. There were people who infiltrated organizations purely for the purpose of trying to present those organizations as being dangerous to the media, to the rest of the country. I saw it in Ferguson 6 years ago. So when we hear stories, when I talk to my friends and colleagues who are in Minneapolis who say, yes, after the curfew, the vast majority of the protesters and demonstrators go home, and then you have white nationalists and Proud Boys marching through the streets. There was a report this morning from NBC talking about the fact that you had white nationalist organizations pretending and creating fake Twitter accounts claiming that they were Antifa, saying that they were going to attack white neighborhoods. Yes, we can disentangle the men and women who are out there every day saying, hey, look, we need to do something about the police. We need to do something about accountability. And the numerous and sundry people who are out there trying to basically surf off of this movement to sow chaos and whatever agenda they have. It's just a matter of using the right language and recognizing who's really speaking and who's causing trouble.
Let's take a phone call. David in Englewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I think you guys are living in a bubble, including Ms. Greer. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I'm old enough to remember the riots after King. And the real people that are going to really hurt from this is not the liberals in Manhattan and Brooklyn and other places. It's the people that live in these neighborhoods that are being trashed every day, destroying businesses, many of whom probably do not have insurance. And even those big stores like Target, do they really want to open up in a place where their store is destroyed? I mean, they provide employment. And it's just really sad. We are witnessing the failure of 50 years of liberalism, because all that liberals do is warehouse the poor in places like NYCHA. If liberals really cared about black people, the first thing they would do is every liberal, they talk about empowerment and all this kind of stuff. Give every black child a voucher so that they can escape these schools that none of these liberals, including some of the people in the de Blasio administration, they selected their kids' school. Give these people an opportunity to get out of these failing schools in Newark and everywhere else, but they won't do that because the unions control the Democratic Party.
David, I'm gonna leave it there. You put a lot on the table. Jason Johnson, you want to respond to some of the bigger thoughts in there? Points of view.
It was absolute nonsense, and it's ahistorical. And I think it's important that we use these kinds of terms. You don't have to go back to slavery. You can just go back 50 or 60 years and talk about how the GI Bill was denied to black soldiers who came back, the GI Bill that allowed white soldiers to come back after World War II to build the very suburbs that segregated them from black people, which allowed us to have tremendous amount of difficulty for the last half century getting the education and the loans that we needed to build the communities that we seldom get to control because of occupying police forces continue to kill people in the street and not face accountability despite the fact that they're killing taxpayers. That's where this comes from. But it's a larger problem here about the kind of rhetoric that's used when we discuss police violence and racism. I don't care about Republicans. I don't care about Democrats. I don't care about partisanship. I'm a taxpayer. George Floyd was a taxpayer. Breonna Taylor was a taxpayer. They were citizens. Ahmaud Arbery was a taxpayer. They're being murdered by police officers. They're being murdered by vigilante individuals, and they're not being held accountable. And to the degree that people want to distract this and turn this into a larger conversation about partisanship, they are failing to acknowledge the humanity of the hundreds of men and women who are being killed every single day so that they can fight over votes. And I want to close with this because I think this is also key. This president has failed at almost every single level to manage these kinds of conditions. You talk about businesses that are being burned right now. How many studies, how many reports have we seen of African-American, black and brown and women-owned businesses who haven't gotten supportive checks from the president of the United States, from this administration during the pandemic? When these neighborhoods are being burned down, is that because of the behavior of protesters, or is, as I wrote for Vox and I wrote for The Griot, a lot of times it's police munitions that are ending up causing these fires? And again, the police and their insurance policies never have to pay for a building where tear gas goes inside an office, goes inside a T-Mobile, and sets the place on fire. So I think we need to be honest with ourselves about American history. We need to be honest about ourselves about where things are now. And we have to fight back in the press and our personal lives and the social media on people who would give us an ahistoric example of how we got to where we are to justify whatever partisan beliefs that they came into the conversation with.
Christina, the caller addressed you on property damage, and you teach at Fordham University. Here's a headline from News 12, The Bronx, today about an area not far from the campus. It was a chaotic scene near Fordham Road Monday night into Tuesday morning as looters damaged several stores following yet another day of protests in New York City, unquote. So those local merchants, I'm sure you would say, are innocent victims. Do you have an opinion about how the NYPD, or the public for that matter, should respond?
Well, I mean, we know that the NYPD is relatively incapable of viewing many New Yorkers as human beings in the way that they've treated the residents of New York for generations. I also just want to clarify a few things. I mean, the caller talked about vouchers. First of all, Miss Greer is my mother. She's lovely, but I'm Dr. Greer because I study this, and there are theories behind what I'm saying. I think we also have to question how we define welfare and vouchers. You know, there's been lots of welfare given out by this nation from our elected officials to wealthy white Americans. We've seen it in the trillions of dollars that have gone out with COVID relief, but we've seen it over time. The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Immigration Act, all passed under Democratic leadership because Republicans refused to want to recognize people of color as real human beings in this nation. And voucher systems don't work in a highly white nationalist, anti-black, racist structure. So all you're doing is replicating the same system, just slightly to the right or slightly to the left. So we really need to think about how these policies, as Jason mentioned, over time in education, in housing, in employment, in health, in public health, have been deliberate to make sure that people of color in this nation live in a less equitable society. And until we're honest about that particular conversation, we can't move towards resolution or healing or apologies, because we haven't even diagnosed and fully acknowledged the cancer that this nation is predicated on.
My guests are Christina Greer from Fordham, Jason Johnson from Morgan State, both from The Griot. And we've been going first names all around here because Christina and I know each other for a long time and we're on a first name basis. And Dr. Johnson, I brought you in on the first name basis so we wouldn't be calling each other different things. I hope that's okay.
That's fine, Brian.
Absolutely, Brian. I'm making that point just because there are lots of, this is a gendered conversation where when it comes to women speaking about politics, they seem to forget that many of us actually study this for a living.
Absolutely. The caller called you Miss Greer. I get that. Presidential candidate Joe Biden has just made a statement that includes, I am told, because I haven't heard it, an agenda for his first 100 days in office, if he is elected president this fall, that addresses the underlying issues that the country is dealing with today. Here's about a minute and a half of Joe Biden from just a few minutes ago.
Paraphrase Reverend Barber, it's the morning where we find hope. It's in the morning where we find hope when we mourn. But it's going to take more than talk. We've had talk before. We've had protests before. We've got to now vow to make this at least an era of action and reverse the systemic racism with a long overdue concrete changes. The action will not be completed in the first 100 days of my presidency if I'm fortunate enough to be elected, or even in my entire term. It's going to take the work of a generation. But if this agenda will take time to complete, it should not wait for the first 100 days of my presidency to get started. A down payment on what is long overdue should come now, should come immediately. I call on the Congress to act this month on measures that will be the first step in this direction, starting with real police reform. Congressman Jeffries has a bill to outlaw chokeholds. Congress should put it on the president's desk in the next few days. There are other measures to stop transferring weapons of war to police forces, improve oversight and accountability, to create a model use of force standard. That also should be made law this month. No more excuses, no delays. If Mitch McConnell can bring in the United States Senate to confirm Trump's unqualified judicial nominees who will run roughshod over our Constitution now, it's time to pass legislation that will give true meaning to our constitutional promise of equal protection under the law.
Christina Greer, on those specific pieces of legislation that former Vice President Biden was promoting, do those matter?
I think it's a start. I mean, I think we also have to remember that, you know, it's protest politics and electoral politics that have to work hand in hand. It's not enough just to take to the streets. We have to translate that anger and that passion into substantive policymaking. So I think that that is a beginning. I mean, I think a lot of Democrats recognize that Joe Biden is not a perfect candidate for whatever reason. But I think what does give some people comfort is that he's actually willing to listen to people who have specialties and expertise. He actually wants to work with Congress and doesn't believe that Congress should answer to him in a capacity as a dictator. He understands and respects the role of the presidency and understands and respects the role of the three branches of government working in conjunction to move forward with democracy. So I think we have to recognize that we need leadership on the local, state, and federal level who can take these uprisings in communities across the nation and translate them into the policies that people are asking and begging for.
We're just about out of time, but Jason, let me ask you sort of a deeper history question. I mean, in the present, even before the uprising, people were talking about the savage inequality of who was dying from COVID-19 as a potential catalyst for meaningful structural change. And after the urban unrest of 1967, the Lyndon Johnson federal government, as you know, impaneled the Kerner Commission to address root causes. And what did they cite? Structural racism in general, but in particular, housing inequality, policing inequality and brutality, predatory lending, voter suppression. Does this all sound familiar? Why didn't that keep us from where we are today if we look back on the Kerner Commission as an earnest effort?
Because while there may have been an earnest effort, there was not an earnest intent to actually implement these things. I mean, the Groundhog Day element of America's racial and structural economic problems should drive us all nuts. I mean, we keep seeing the same issues over and over and over again. And look, I would tell you, Dr. Greer knows this, you know, Brian, you know this. The plans are out there. Everybody knows what's wrong. Everybody knows. I mean, you can't go to a local city. You can't go to a local city council and not find stacks and stacks of paper on how to address inequalities in education, how to address inequalities in healthcare. The plans are there. Heck, the plans to deal with COVID were there. Obama left them for Donald Trump. He threw them in the garbage. So it's never been an issue that we don't know what to do in this country. It's always been an issue of people not being willing to do what's right there in front of them. And what we're facing right now is a global pandemic, an impending global recession, and massive, massive upheaval, and we're just in the first early days of June. And I don't think this president will handle it. And one thing I was happy about, I've got to say this about Joe Biden, is at least he has the humility now, months away from the election, to say, I'm not going to be able to fix all these problems in my first term. I'm just going to have to start making an effort. And at least we can hear that from him, because there's no plan from Donald Trump right now.
Jason Johnson, professor at Morgan State University, political contributor at MSNBC, contributor to The Griot, and to SiriusXM, and Christina Greer, political science professor at Fordham, host of the podcast FAQ NYC, politics editor at The Griot, and author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.